This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss what's been accomplished at the 26th UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow. So far, nations have pledged to protect forests, cut methane gas emissions, and phase out coal. Last month, the UN reported that the world is on track for a catastrophic 2.7 degrees Celsius rise by the year 2100. So, what was really accomplished, and what is the role of the media in highlighting the plight of those affected the most by the climate crisis? Joining us now is Tina Gerhardt, an environmental justice reporter who covers climate change, UN climate negotiations, and energy policies. And you can find Tina's latest pieces at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Tina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, Tina, we had a few young people on the show yesterday, a young person who was at the conference and then one of the young hunger strikers who spent almost 2 weeks hunger striking in front of the White House. And one of the main comments they had was that because of vaccine issues, the high cost of getting to the conference, the people who are most affected by the climate crisis were not in attendance in large numbers at COP. What are your thoughts on that?
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think Alok Sharma, the COP26 president, had at the outset or even before COP started, he wanted this to be the most inclusive. And COP26, in fact, has been called the whitest and the wealthiest UN climate negotiations. And the reasons for that are, as you mentioned, I would call it vaccine apartheid. There's also visa issues, and then there's the cost of attending. There's been a lot of price gouging that's been documented by hotels and Airbnb, with reservations being canceled and then going for over well $1,000 per night, just to keep on the theme of youth that you were mentioning. I know Alexandria Villaseñor had been trying to help get people into hotel rooms and tweeted out that she couldn't find anything under $1,500.
Wow.
Earlier this week, I think a third of Pacific Island nations are not attending. They remain relatively COVID-free because they closed their borders to international travel. But it was the cost, really. Like, in order to attend, they would have had to have paid for a month of hotel fees, 2 weeks for the conference and 2 weeks for the quarantine for their entire delegation. And when you're talking over $1,000 a night per person, you know, those costs are just prohibitive. I think no one from Haiti, no Haitian delegates are attending because of the complicated application process. So, yeah, what the person you interviewed yesterday said is absolutely right.
So this is a big question, but I just wonder what your thoughts are on coverage so far. I mean, The Guardian has really ramped up their coverage. They've just done incredible reporting. You have written a piece for Sierra Magazine. They do great reporting. What are your thoughts overall about the coverage coming out of COP, especially in the U.S.?
I appreciate that question very much. And the reference to The Guardian, I think, is spot on. They're fantastic for their coverage on climate change, and especially of COP20, of the annual UN climate negotiations. Fiona Harvey is one of their journalists, and she's really focused on this and has been for over a decade. So their coverage is absolutely fantastic. And I'm covering for The Nation and for Sierra, so for both of those venues. I think in terms of the coverage, an issue that I generally have, and I've been covering the climate negotiations for a decade, an issue that I generally have with the climate negotiations is that there tends to be, and I think this is shifting, there tends to be a real focus on the U.S.-China standoff. And I don't know how much that's going to change this year, with China, at least, you know, China's Xi Jinping not being in attendance in person, even if delegates are. But that's really the focus. And I want to be totally clear on this. I don't think the U.S.-China relations are unimportant. My concern there is what that occludes from view that's going on inside the halls of the U.N. And I think that, you know, that gets at your question. So just to give your listeners a bit of a sketch of what does happen inside, because one hears so much about the greenwashing efforts and some of the businesses that are attending in those sideshows. But when you're actually in the main hall, what you hear is you, what you hear is from negotiators from nations around the world, and they stand up one by one, but also as part of clusters. For example, to use UN speak, the Africa Group, Least Developed Countries, Alliance of Small Island States, Small Island Developing States, and so on. And they then stand up one by one, and before they weigh in on whatever point is up for discussion, they often first mention the situation in their home countries. And given that the UN climate negotiations typically fall on the heels of the cyclone, hurricane, typhoon season, I mean, they're a little earlier this year, but usually they're in December, the reports tend to be really devastating. And this year is really no different. So the conference opened with breathtaking speeches by youth activists that really went viral quickly. There was a speech by Elizabeth Watuti from Kenya, and she shared how climate change was affecting people and communities in Africa, mentioning that 2 million fellow Kenyans face starvation as both the rainy seasons have failed and the rivers have run dry and the crops are failing, animals and people are dying. And she underscored this isn't only happening in Kenya. She also mentioned heat waves and wildfires in Algeria and devastating floods in Nigeria, and mentioned how she was influenced by Wangari Maathai, the very famous Kenyan activist, first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
So it was, as you say, incredible. We were watching a lot of videos yesterday of the young people who spoke, because mm-hmm. we had a few young people on the show, and it's so really incredible to just hear those voices. If you just do a quick search, you know, COP Youth, you can find a lot of young voices. Let's talk about some of the things that are happening there, because so much is coming out of Glasgow. I wanted to ask you about this. This got a lot of attention yesterday, just reading from the New York Times, over 40 countries pledge at UN Climate Summit to end use of coal power. More than 40 countries pledge to phase out coal, the dirtiest fossil fuel, in a deal announced at the UN Climate Summit. But several of the biggest coal consumers were notably absent from the accord, including China and India, which together burn two-thirds of the world's coal, as well as Australia, the world's 11th biggest user of coal and a major exporter. The United States, which generates about one-fifth of its electricity from coal, also did not sign the pledge. So 40 countries are pledging to phase out coal, but the biggest emitters are not, including the United States and China. How is this being discussed and received at the conference?
Yeah, that is a really important topic. I filed an article yesterday with The Nation that should be out sometime soon on this very topic, so your listeners can look for that. The fact that of the five different emitting nations that you mentioned, China, India, U.S., Australia, and Indonesia, four of them did not sign on. The exception there is Indonesia. That is a really big problem. It is really being celebrated. It is a very important achievement. And of course, I had to think of Marianne Hitt, who was the former director of Beyond Coal campaign at Sierra Club for over a decade. She tweeted out, just never thinking that, you know, that one could come to this moment where COP26 is announcing that coal is going to be consigned to history. That said, there's a lot of issues. I mean, you outlined, you know, some of the problems that four of the five major emitters have not signed on. A couple of other issues are that developed, this is UN speak again, not my language, that developed nations have to phase out by 2030 and developing nations should phase out by 2040. Now, the science put forward by the IPCC states that the most radical emission cuts have to be made in this decade by 2030. So there's that issue with the lag to the 2040s for the developing nations. The other issue that hasn't really received much coverage that I'm doing a subsequent piece on that focuses a bit more on the Global South and funding issues, and that one's for Sierra. The other issue there is really the funding. So developed nations in Copenhagen in 2009 agreed to give developing nations $100 billion per year in order to help them transition to basically deal with the effects of climate change. And then they are also expecting monies in order to help them transition off of fossil fuels. So when you see some of these big emitting nations not signing on of the five major emitters, and I'm thinking here specifically of India, one of the things to take note of is that they need monies in order to be able to make that transition happen. So the fact that monies that were promised have not been forthcoming is preventing a transition in the developing world. And there was an agreement, I mean, this is good news, there was an agreement that was signed with South Africa where they are going to be getting $18.5 billion in order to transition. And apparently India has also signed on. And that's called a just transition. And that's part of the UN.
What's standing in the way of those funds? Because we've been talking about this for so many years.
That's a fantastic question, and I think that is really an issue that the activists, youth activists, people from the Global South, their allies, have really been pushing forward on. And I want to be clear, too, there's not necessarily a division between being inside and outside the halls of the UN negotiations. There are many nations from the Global South who are pushing for these kinds of changes because they're directly impacted, right? So they have pointed out that funds were easily found in bailing out certain industries after COVID, that funds were easily found in the wake of the 2008 financial meltdown. So that's a question that they're raising. John Kerry last night at a dinner that he had, and I saw just one article on this, he announced that the funds are going to become available starting next year. And there's been studies, I mean, the OECD did a study that because those funds were not granted, the amount that is now, because of the lag, the amount that is now needed has gone up.
Today we're speaking with Tina Gerhardt, an environmental journalist and academic. You can find her pieces about the climate crisis at yourcallradio.org. Tina, let's talk about the latest piece you wrote in Sierra Magazine called Methane's Big Moment. Major sources of methane emissions include fossil fuels like coal, petroleum, and gas, particularly flaring and leaks from oil and gas wells and pipelines. You write that one way to reduce methane would be to stop the construction of new gas-fired power plants and to ensure that leaks are reduced and capped. So tell us what happened at COP. The EU and the US officially launched the Global Methane Pledge. What exactly is in that pledge?
Yeah, so that's a pledge. I think every day seems to have kind of a focus here at COP. So that was the focus on Tuesday, along with forests, which you mentioned in the opening. And the Global Methane Pledge is something that the U.S. has been working on together with the EU. And they announced that nations had signed on, 105 countries as of when I wrote that story, were participating in the Global Methane Pledge. And what it is members who sign on, signatories, agree to cut methane emissions by at least 30% by 2030. So the good news there is that those reductions are pledged to be made by 2030, that crucial year, this decade, the one to make change. The UN is also, as part of this, establishing an agency that's going to be tracking emissions and also reductions, and that's going to, in its intention, going to help support efforts to regulate it. I think what's important to know in terms of methane, one of the main sources of it is natural gas, and so all of the fracking that's been done across the U.S. is really implicated in the increase in methane. And the reason that it's good news, this methane announcement, I mean, the bad news about methane is it's 80 times more potent than CO2 emissions. The good news is it breaks down in about a decade, whereas CO2 emissions take centuries to break down. And realizing that this work has to be done this decade, I think rightly so, people were looking at what's the low-hanging fruit, if you will, where you can make cuts right now that are going to have impacts and be helpful. We still have to get at the emissions from CO2. We still have to get at other fossil fuels. And there are critics of the methane agreement who have rightly been pointing out that some of the talk of methane or of coal is shifting the focus from other fossil fuels. And I think that's also an important criticism. But I think this could be really helpful. Capping is key. You mentioned that. I think what's important there for listeners to know is we're not only talking about existing wells, we're also talking about abandoned wells. Methane is a really leaky gas. It likes to escape. The scientist I talked to for the article told me it just really likes to jump out. And so capping it from both existing and also old wells is really important. And in terms of that, there's two new rules, I guess, that President Biden announced that are really important. One of them is intended to expand regulations to capping oil and gas pipelines from existing oil and gas pipelines. There had already been a law that Obama put into effect in 2015. That was when it was passed. I think it took effect in 2016. And that was for new gas pipelines. And this one by Biden is for existing ones. And the other one through the Department of Transportation is to reduce leaks in natural gas pipelines. So those two are going to have incredible effect.
And final thoughts before we let you go in our final minute, what really strikes you about what you're hearing from activists who are attending COP or who are protesting, especially indigenous activists, indigenous people who are trying to raise awareness about all of the activists who've been killed for defending the land, the air, and the water?
It is a really risky business. I think that's important to note in countries around the world for activists and also for journalists. In my sense, over the past decade, the conversation has really shifted. Mm-hmm. The voices are so vibrant. There's such an array of voices right now, youth, indigenous activists. I mean, it's really incredible. And I do feel like the tide has turned in terms of the awareness of this issue being key for our time.
Tina Gerhardt is an environmental journalist who covers the climate crisis. You can find her latest pieces at yourcallradio.org. Tina, thanks so much for covering these issues, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we mentioned the story about the 40 countries pledging at the UN Climate Summit to end the use of coal power. And we talked about the United States not signing on to this. The New York Times reports that U.S. officials decided that signing the pledge could anger Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, according to the officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to publicly discuss the negotiations. A spokeswoman for Mr. Manchin did not respond to the New York Times request for comment. So just wanted to add that in there, and you can read that piece at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Joanne Marr for engineering the show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.